I said to Gary Allen and Micah when we started The Rest Is Football, I want the green room chat. I don't want the chat you hear on national television. I want the fun one. I want Alan Shearer to tell the public that he hates Sunderland. He doesn't have to pretend anything else. You know, I want the lads to be able to enjoy it, to behave with the passion and fandom I see in them when I see them, which I don't get when they're on traditional TV.
Hello and welcome to Outlines, a podcast about sport, stories and the media. My name's Owen Connolly. Hope you're well. It is great to have you listening. Now, modern media is increasingly fluid, and that's especially apparent right now in the world of podcasting, a medium that's long been defined by its accessibility and its capacity to reach any and every niche, has also shown more and more creative boldness, commercial sophistication, and crossover potential. And most notably, podcasts have very much made the leap from a purely audio experience to a visual one as well. Our guest this time is extremely well placed to talk us through that transition. Tony Pastor is the co-founder of Goalhanger, the UK's biggest independent podcast production company, whose shows rack up tens of millions of downloads every month. Goalhanger started out making sports documentaries for television before experimenting with podcasts a few years ago, and it duly created some of the UK's very biggest hits, like The Rest Is Politics, The Rest Is Entertainment, and the unlikely global phenomenon that is The Rest Is History. Currently, there's only one sports show in that portfolio, but it's one that's starting to push at the boundaries of what podcasts can be. The Rest Is Football, hosted by another Goalhanger co-founder, Gary Lineker, alongside Alan Shearer and Micah Richards, has in the past year been part of video rights deals with DAZN for 2025's expanded FIFA Club World Cup, with La Liga, and with the Premier League for its archive. And this summer, the boys will be taking their talents to Netflix throughout the FIFA World Cup in Canada, Mexico, and the US. I spoke to Tony about how all those partnerships have reshaped the show's identity and what they say about where podcasts are in 2026. We discussed the Goalhanger journey, its programming formula, what the podcast industry can tell advertisers about audience behavior and the future of media, building community and adding value through subscriptions, and what it might take to bring more sport to the Goalhanger stable. Have to say, I found it a really interesting and insightful hour. Hope you do too. As ever, if you're enjoying this podcast series, then anything you can do to help keep it growing will be much appreciated. Subscribe, rate and review on your platform of choice. Details for social media and the Outlines newsletter are in the show notes. Like and share anything you see there. If you're speaking to someone and they say, you know what, I'm on the lookout for a new podcast, ideally something that covers sport and the media and storytelling, well, I reckon this would be the place to send them. In fact, I'd just tell them about it anyway, unprompted. Got to be worth a go. And this would not be a bad episode at all to get them started on. We're talking podcasts and where they go next. Here is Tony Pastor. So, I mean, what's the operation like there now at Goalhanger? It's always quite hard to judge I hesitate to use the term new media, but, you know, when you're doing something like podcasting, the teams can be quite agile. You know, you can have someone on one project and not necessarily be a part of the team full time. So what kind of scale of company are we talking about now?
We're talking about a company that makes 15 podcasts, many of them twice a week, some of them three times a week. So, you know, reasonable scale. We have about 85 staff. If you'd asked me that question a year ago, and it would have been 40 staff. So it's probably doubled year on year, and it would have been 20 the year before. In 2022, I think we were 8. So, you know, it's obviously scaled up pretty rapidly. We're still based in South London, and we have a a very varied team now. We have internal sales team, 14 people in a sales team. We've got a digital team of about 20. And we've got a lot of producers. So, you know, a show like The Rest Is History, which does 27 million downloads a month, takes quite a lot of work and takes quite a lot of infrastructure. It's got two people who manage its community, its membership team. It's got a video editor. It's got social media specialists. It's got researchers, producers, exec producers. You know, it's quite. It's no longer the kind of cottage industry you do on your kitchen table.
Yeah. I mean, what? So that kind of that growth has come independently of, you know, it's not. I mean, you do more shows than you did a couple of years ago, but it's not just a question of every time you have a new show, you bring on a team or what have you. There's actually functions there. You know, I mean, we'll get into kind of the real sophistication of some of the operations around these podcasts, but it's a question of what you need to deliver as much as, you know, just how many different products you got out there.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, The Rest Is History started out with, you know, me, my co-founder, Jack, and one producer, Dom, you know, getting it going in the first place. And now it's a pretty sophisticated, you know, very modern media product with, you know, live shows and tours overseas. You know, it's a sophisticated beast. The Rest Is Politics is even more so because it's so timely. The Rest Is History has the advantage that, you know, by and large, the history doesn't get out of date. We can make a series, you know, about ancient Carthage, and it's still relevant in 6 months as it is now. So you can get ahead of yourself. The Rest Is Politics never does that. It's constantly working. You know, the guys are in Spain today talking to the prime minister over there. And, you know, and last week, Alistair was in Ukraine. You know, you've got to be bouncing around and being very timely. So that is a heavier lift in production terms.
Yeah. Let's take it back a bit and look at where Goal Hangers come from. Because, you know, you started out, you were kind of documentary production company, basically. Yep. How did you find yourself going in this direction?
So yeah, I set up Goal Hanger in when I left ITV. I ran the sports production department at ITV for 4 years. Then I left and I set up basically an independent production company that would make specializing in sports documentaries, usually working with big talent. So our first show was. I got Roy Keane and Patrick Vieira to sit down together and talk about the old days, and it was the first time they'd sort of come back and really discuss that great rivalry. It did really, really well. Gary saw it, loved it, called me up. We had a meeting, decided we were going to do this together, and we were a very traditional model, making shows for commissioners. So you know, BBC, ITV, Channel 4, NBC in the States. We made for the History Channel. We made TV shows, and that model has been the same model for a long time, and it worked. It was a successful boutique small company that would have a core staff of 6 or 7 and would grow to 20, 25 during big productions, but. It, very traditional. You have an idea, you take it to a commissioner, you persuade the commissioner it's a good idea, hopefully. Most of the time you fail to persuade the commissioner, obviously. That's by how it works. And then occasionally you would succeed, and you'd often have a big talent attached. They'd give you a budget, you'd agree a budget, and the model is you get to keep a 10% production fee, and that's that. In 2019, we were doing this, as I say, successfully, growing a small amount each year. And then I decided to experiment with podcasting. And very, very rapidly, it became a breakout success. And the beauty of it was I no longer had to persuade the commissioner that my ideas were something they should back, that they should give us part of their hard-earned budget for. We could do it ourselves and go direct to the consumer. And although the monetization in the early days was immature, it was just very simple, because it was difficult, the monetization, because there were not a lot of advertisers out there, because we didn't really understand the world, we became scrappy and very entrepreneurial and like a real startup. And we incubated it within the business, and it basically took over the whole thing.
Yeah. Was there a point where you could sense that happening?
Yeah. Basically, in 2020, we launched The Rest Is History. The Rest Is History very rapidly became very successful. In fact, it started, I mean, we outsourced all our commercial operations at that time. We would put our shows out. We are producers. That's what we were doing. We were producing shows. We were managing talent. We were creating narrative series. You know, we were doing what producers do. And we were outsourcing the monetization to a company called Acast, which is a very successful ad sales company that specializes in podcasting. And each month they would literally send us a report saying, well done, you did this many ads were served. This is your share of it. And that started to grow to the point where we thought, blimey, this has got real potential, you know. It's no longer a sort of kind of quasi hobby. It's becoming something that is that's sustainable in its own right. And we doubled down. We launched The Rest is Politics off the back of that. And it immediately found a massive audience. And we realized we were onto something. And, you know, for a while we ran the film company and the podcast company in tandem. And then a couple of years ago, we decided this is the future. Let's completely pivot to this and double down on it. And, you know, obviously it's worked.
Yeah. Yeah. What's your take now on where the podcasting space is in 2026? I mean, we're going to get into some of the stuff you're doing, particularly around The Rest is Football. I mean, this is a sports media podcast.
Yeah, sure.
But also, you know, because some of the innovation that we're seeing over there and some of the kind of co-mingling of podcasting with other forms of media. But what's your general impression of the sector?
The sector is still maturing. So it is still not understood by the advertising community, for example. So, you know, one of our jobs as the UK's largest independent podcast company is to keep banging the drum and saying to the advertising community, to the agencies, to the brands, look, you're missing out on a great opportunity here because, you know, we have very, very engaged audiences. This is not passive. It's not like sticking commercial radio in the car when you're dropping the kids at school and having a bit of talk radio or music. This is a lean in exercise. People are listening, usually with headphones on. They're often walking the dog, exercising, commuting, cooking, etc. And they're actively choosing to spend a lot of time with these shows. And all the evidence is that that's a very compelling thing for the brands that form partnerships with these shows. But that hasn't been fully realized in the UK. In America, it has, of course, because they're miles ahead of us. So, you know, it's probably a £100 million advertising industry in the UK, and it's a £4.5 billion advertising industry in the US. And that's clearly way out of proportion to the difference in population. So I think there's still loads of headroom. I mean, hardly anybody over 55 listens to podcasts. It's nearly all people in their 20s, 30s, 40s. So as people age and become more digitally native and comfortable with the technology, there's just masses of growth available. I every time I hear somebody say we're at peak podcasting, I laugh because it's just so clearly untrue.
Yeah. How does that present itself, that gap between what's possible and what advertisers are currently willing or prepared or in a position to do? You know, is it a practical thing? Is it a fulfillment thing? Is it just still kind of underestimating the format or being, you know?
Well, the other thing about it, Owen, is that there's a lot of very old school practices in British media and advertising. So, for example, a lot of the agencies have still got what are called trading agreements with channels. So they'll have a deal that says X million pounds of Channel 5's money or ITV's money, whoever it is, Sky's money will come through their agency, and it has to be distributed through their brands. You know, they've got very quite strict traditional methodologies. So what we found initially, and still to some degree, is that it's often brands that are breaking into new sectors. So, for example, The Rest is Politics was sponsored all last year by Fuse Energy. Fuse Energy is a challenger brand in the energy sector. So, you know, it's trying to grow a customer base in the UK. It's done that really, really successfully. And The Rest is Politics helped it last year grow its customer base by a factor of five, increased it fivefold. Now, that's because they needed massive awareness for their brand, and we were able to provide it for. Some of the more traditional brands just think that, you know, popping up popping up on a traditional linear TV channel is the answer. But I think increasingly we're seeing that cash migrate across.
Yeah, is there a signal thing there? You know, the fact that TV advertising, conventional advertising in that way has always been seen as like, once you get to that point as a brand, A, you can spend that kind of money on production. But also, this is where the more prestigious brands sit, is still, there's still something of that mindset in how some parts of paid media work.
Yeah, that might be true. I mean, I think that, you know, it's impossible for this to continue in that regard, because the average age of a viewer of a, you know, of linear TV is so old. I mean, do you really want to be trying to sell your sparkling new car to people where the average age of the audience is 67? I mean, what's the point? You know, I think increasingly people will come to understand that if you want to get to like the highest group of people who we know our demographics intimately, really inside out, we're massively data driven, right? So I can tell you that the vast majority of our audience is aged between 25 and 44. The vast majority of it, you know, 2/3 or more is in that sector. The single section of household earnings, the highest group, is the north of £100,000 group. They are by far the more likely to be educated to degree level. They average 2.7 holidays a year. This is a very attractive audience. But what I'm saying at the minute is many of the prestige brands have not figured that out.
Yeah.
And it's our job, by the way, it's our job to educate the advertising audience that this is the case.
Yeah. We're going down a bit of a rabbit hole here, but I'm finding this quite interesting. Do you think there's going to be a degree to which some of that comes through tailoring or you know, you companies like yours working with advertisers to think, here is how this is going to work in this medium? Just a radio ad or a presenter, sure, read, but something that's maybe that maybe builds on some of that stuff, or is it just going to be a kind of a dam breaking and people realizing where their audiences are most engaged?
Well, I mean, I can only speak from our side, which is that we are increasingly sophisticated in terms of what we are able to offer. So our sales team will talk to a brand, and it won't be just getting the host to read an ad at the start or middle of the show. It'll also invariably include a burnt in ad on YouTube. It'll be a dynamically inserted ad that targets a specific audience in a specific territory. It'll be a social media activation. It might even have a live event part of it. So I think as you become more sophisticated in your offering, the really smart brands will say, that is valuable. It is more useful to me to interact with an audience directly through a newsletter, through a live event, through the social media interaction, than it is to literally have an ad playing out passively on in a traditional way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, speaking of the kind of sophistication of the offer, I mean, you know, you don't have many sports shows in your catalog, despite the origins of the company in sports, yeah, docs. But it is a show that's doing really, really interesting things in terms of where it's appearing and some of the partnerships you're doing kind of on the right side. And that's The Rest Is Football.
Yeah.
When you launched that show, first of all, where were you trying to create a point of difference from, you know, there's a lot of football podcasts out there.
There's a lot of football podcasts, which is why we didn't do it straight away. And you've got to be really, really clear about what your offer is to make you distinctive. So there are two things. First of all, footballers by and large are very well paid, as I'm sure you're aware. So if you want to work with the likes of Micah Richards, Alan Shearer, Gary Lineker, you know, you have to be pretty comfortable that you are going to offer value for their time. So in the very early days of podcasting, that would have been impossible. So if you look around, it's relatively recent that the big stars of football, of sport generally, are in the podcasting world. It's traditionally been journalists, fans, etc. You know, and lots of great things. You know, I'm a Burnley supporter. You know, if you want to go and listen to a podcast about your club, there's two or three offerings, and you can go and get something very bespoke for you. very suited to your passions. But what we wanted to do was find a way to get the biggest names onto a show. And we also wanted it to have a different tone of voice. So I've produced an awful lot of live football down the years. And what I always say to the people that make those shows and or are on screen is all the best conversations were happening in the green room. So you'd go and do Match of the Day or a Champions League show at ITV. And before the guys would go on set, you know, they'd be gossiping, telling you what's going on, you know, insightful, slagging off things they don't like or clubs they're not into. And I said, then they go on air and they effectively, metaphorically correct their tie, pull on their blazer and become relatively hidebound and straightforward in their comments, you know. I said to Gary Allen and Micah when we started The Rest Is Football, I want the green room chat. I don't want the chat you hear on national television. I want the fun one. I want Alan Shearer to tell the public that he hates Sunderland. He doesn't have to pretend anything else. You know, I want the lads to be able to enjoy it, to behave with the passion and fandom I see in them when I see them, which I don't get when they're on traditional TV. And so, big names, tone of voice, audience really enjoys it. That is pretty clear cut. I mean, you know, Gary Neville has done something very similar with Stick to Football. He's got the biggest names and it's very, very entertaining. You know, I'm hugely respectful of it. And it's because they've also got a different tone of voice, I think, than, you know, you see a different side of Roy and Jamie than perhaps you do on national telly.
Yeah, yeah. How does that process take hold of kind of losing the broadcaster thing, which of course they've also been trained into?
Yep.
Like, you know,
yep.
I mean, Gary is now a very seasoned presenter and probably quite happy in his own skin doing live TV, but
yep.
That took 30 years. And Alan Shearer, similarly, he has been doing it for nearly 20 years.
Yeah.
Micah now for about 10. And it's all, you know, I know that the modes of presentation in sports media have changed a bit in the last decade or so, but yep. Not to that extent. So, you know, how much, where do you, how do you carry that process through of making them feel comfortable in a different setting and in a different context?
Well, there's a number of ways. I mean, the first is that, you know, we're not in a gotcha tabloid world here. The boys are part of the process of the show and they say what they want to say and nobody's forcing them to do anything they don't want to do at any time or comment on things they might not want to. They're very, very relaxed. I mean, Gary Allen and Mike are our friends. Do you want to see the WhatsApp group between them? Like the weekend, well, last night during the Champions League, I was watching Real Madrid play Man City last night. I put my phone down for off and I come back, I got 93 missed messages and they're all Gary Allen and Micah backwards and forwards on, should that have been a penalty, as he died, you know, it's brilliant. So all you really ask for is that they close the gap between their natural behaviours and how they talk to each other and their relationship and show as much of that on air as they can. And they've really got it. I mean, they're all bright lads. They're all smart. They're all really, really intelligent ex-footballers, and they bring a real intelligence to the way that they do it. And I think I see on Gary Neville's show very, very similar traits.
Yeah, I mean, I seem to remember there was a bridge point, wasn't there? Because there was that period during COVID, where the three of them were doing these sort of podcast style shows, just because it was. You know, it was the 10 greatest strikers and the 10 greatest teams or something like that. Because obviously, TV was hard to make in that period.
Well, absolutely. And we did that for the BBC. That was actually a commission. That was Match of the Day Top 10, which was a great, great, lovely project. And we actually started that with Righty. And we started it. We filmed it in Gary's house. We filmed three episodes in Gary's house in his kitchen. Gary made a spectacular lunch and we had a brilliant day. And then COVID hit. And I remember the BBC contacted me and said, did you film it? And we said, well, funnily enough, we did actually just for social media clips. And they went, well, if you can cut it together and it makes sense, we'll put it out on Saturday night on BBC One. It was absolutely revelatory. And I think in a way that show, I think you've picked the right point in time because that show was doing millions of audience and was basically three lads sat round a table chatting about the footy. And what I think it shows you is that TV had gone very hard down a line of uber production. And in fact, the audience was much more bothered about the tonal feel of it, not whether it was in a flashy studio, you know, green screened with and, you know, creating some wondrous backdrop effect. I just think the public showed that they just wanted to hear the lads talk.
I mean, the show's gone through a real evolution in the last 12 months. You had, you know, you've had rights partnerships with DAZN for the Club World Cup and then with La Liga. How did those opportunities come about, first of all?
And also with the Premier League, that's our latest. So we've got archival rights to the Premier League from 1992 to the present, till the end of last season. So the DAZN thing came about because we had a conversation with them. I can't remember whether I approached them, but basically they had acquired the Club World Cup at a huge amount of expense, and they didn't really have a natural marketing tool to tell the public about it. And I said to them, how about we'll promote the living daylights out of the tournament for you. We'll tell everybody what time the games are on and where to find it. And in exchange, you give us some clips. And we actually did a contra deal, and they were really progressive about it and said, yeah, we're up for it. If we can get Gary Allen and Micah to be talking about the Club World Cup and treat it with the kind of respect that a major international club tournament should be treated with, then we'll give you the goals. And it was, you know, absolutely revelatory. You know, it kind of, our video offering was supercharged. And it just felt like we were bridging this interesting gap between being traditionally an audio product. Then we'd become a video product, but relatively simplistically, you know, effectively a glorified Zoom call. And then we're suddenly adding on goals. Then La Liga rights were up. I got in touch with the agency representing them, Media Pro, and they said, well, we're open to this, you know, how would it work? And I bought the rights for us to be able to show La Liga. Sadly, I could only buy them for the UK because of their very complicated international rights structure. So that show can only be seen in the UK. Then the Premier League was the natural evolution. And actually, the Premier League had seen what we were doing with La Liga and thought, this is definitely a door we need to open. And I have to say, the Premier League were excellent, and they allowed us to buy worldwide rights. So we're very unusual in having worldwide clip rights.
Yeah, I want to talk about how you're using those or planning to use those Premier League rights in particular, because that's quite an interesting point creatively. But you know, you talk about that bridge between it going from an audio product to a video product or a video experience, like. Is the rest is football now going to become more so than some of the other shows in your stable because you have those rights, or was it already trending in that direction because of the habits of football fans? What kind of insight can you give that?
It's a good question. That so the first thing to say is that during the Euros in Germany 2 years ago, we threw the kitchen sink at it. We took a production team out, moved them to Berlin for the whole time. Set up a studio in a beautiful apartment. The lads came around every day and recorded shows. We did a show every single day. And it was the very first time that video consumption outstripped audio consumption. That's the first time. We did 19.7 million downloads in 3.5 weeks, and over 10 million of them were video. It was the first time it had tipped into a video-first offering. Our position is always with our shows, we call them eyes optional. You should be able to watch them, but you don't have to watch them. I would say there's one or two shows now, and I would say that the rest is football, the La Liga episode and our Premier League episodes. That's becoming under pressure. I think now it is a much better product if you're watching it than listening. If you can see Patrick Vieira's goals in our latest episode, it's a better product than if you're just listening. But we're also discovering that as a consequence of adding richness to the video offering across all our slate, by the way, the rest is history has two archive deals, which means we can use footage from British Pathé. We can use Getty Images. We've done deals for a lot of our shows now. What we find is the more you improve the quality of the video output, the higher the audience for video. And because YouTube is such a powerful algorithmic beast, it's finding us new audiences all the time. Mm. So there's a general move towards video and richness of video, increasing audience discovery, and ultimately, I hope, retention.
Yeah, and is that true across the board? Because just like, you know, I'm relying on absolutely no data here, and I'm assuming you have quite a lot of it. But it feels like a football audience is going to be on YouTube already, looking for goals, looking for, you know, whether it's kind of one of the broadcasters have put out their reaction thing, and then we'll find their way through to the rest is football. Yep. Whereas the rest is history audience, a lot of that, what was it, 27 million downloads you said a month, you know, there'll be some very hardcore history heads in there, but there's going to be a lot of people for whom this is their kind of only real exposure to these kind of conversations. They're not kind of following that around. Yeah. So, you know, are you seeing differences in those kind of discovery patterns on between your shows?
We are, but you'd be surprised. I mean, so for example, the rest is football is our pretty much of our larger shows. It's our youngest skewing. I think the average age of somebody who consumes the rest is football is 26. You know, they're likely to be men. They're likely to be younger men.
Yeah.
So you're probably right, broadly speaking, in your approach to how which platforms that audience is naturally going to consume on. But you'd be really surprised. Our history audience is not at all what you think it's going to be. It is not. It's not fusty and dusty and you know, members of a golf club in Surrey. It is about 50% of that audience, almost exactly half of that audience is under 44. So you know, it's a very, very significant audience that's younger. And it's also our most successful YouTube channel. It's bigger than you would think. The rest is politics, with all its, you know, with the noise around international affairs, and the rest of politics is very big on YouTube. But the rest is history is bigger, in part because its back catalogue lives forever.
Yeah,
you know, you can have the guys, you know, do four parts on the Falklands War, and it's still as relevant now, you know, now as it was a year and a half ago when they made it. I wouldn't form quite the level of distinction between football and our other offerings as maybe you think.
Yeah. Okay. Another step that you're taking over the summer for the World Cup is this partnership with Netflix for the rest is football, which is, you know, you can see the thinking for them. It's a way of getting a foothold in that World Cup conversation. Again, how did that come about, and how is it going to, you know, you talked about the production that you did out in Germany, but how is it going to affect the way that the show is put together? You know, does it move closer to a more conventional studio-based conversation show, or does it, our audience's expectations now, they're used to watching podcasts, so you can put something that looks more like a podcast on Netflix.
So the way it came about is that they approached us. They called us into their offices in London, and we had no idea why. We went in to see them. I actually thought they were going to ask me if they could acquire the rest of history, because it's got such a massive worldwide audience. In fact, they were very keen on the rest of football, and partly I think that is because during football tournaments generally, but especially in the last Euros, as excitement built around it, basically there's so much football content around, nobody turns on traditional streamers for a month. So that classic thing that we've all done, where you come in on, of an evening and sit down with family and decide, well, let's have a see what's on Netflix or Amazon Prime, etc., just doesn't happen for that month. And so I think they were very keen, as you say, to be part of the football conversation, and also to give people a reason to come back each day and you know, get their World Cup fix. That obviously is not match action, that's not what we're there for. But as we know now, there's an absolute fascination, a hunger, an appetite for really great conversations around the game. We see that from everything, from, you know, Arsenal fan TV, you know, there's all manner of, you know, United Stan, Mark Goldbridge, you know, people love conversation around the game. And, you know, obviously we've got a high end version of that. To your second point, it is going to be a podcast. but it is going to have a very, very, you know, Netflix, you know, we'll have certainly thrown the kitchen sink at the production quality. So it'll be, we'll do it every day from New York. We've got an amazing space overlooking Times Square, and we'll have a fantastic studio. We've got an American Emmy Award winning designer who's putting the whole set together. It's going to look like supercharged TV.
Mm. What does that point to in terms of how podcasts are going to change and the sort of the convergence between podcasts and other established forms of media, particularly on that video side?
Yeah. Well, I think in the end, we can get distracted by what the form is, what it is. But in the end, what do we really want? We want to create compelling content that people want to spend time with. So the average, I'm sounding very statty today, very data-driven. So the average consumption time by somebody watching or listening to one of our shows is 41 minutes. Now, if you are a broadcaster or a distributor, that's a lot of time in one go. That's attractive. In the end, I don't think they care whether you're watching, you know, Wolf Hall at millions of pounds an episode, or whether you're watching The Rest Is History at substantially less than millions of pounds an episode. All they really care about is holding the attention of an audience that is really, really passionate about the product. And that's what we do. We make content that people want to spend lots of time with. We actually, you know, one of our KPIs these days is total watch hours. We want people to spend a lot of time with our content, and we're not trying to do it. We're not trying to cheat. We're not trying to do it on TikTok with viral stuff that gets to, you know, millions of people for 15 seconds. We're trying to get to a discriminating audience that is choosing our content because they love it and who are coming for long periods of time. So in the end, I think people worry too much about whether it's high-end drama, complicated factual, or whether it's a podcast. In the end, it's content that audiences want to spend time with.
Mm. Where does that take you creatively? As I said, I'm intrigued by this Premier League archive rights deal, because it's, you know, again, I strategically can see the fit. You know, you get the guys talking about some of their favorite games, or you get a guest on, or what have yep. you, and you can cut to Patrick Vieira scoring against Spurs in 2004, whatever. How does that change the way that you think as a production company about how you're putting a podcast together from the days when it was purely audio format? And obviously that goes for the rest of its history with the Pathé deal and yep. whatever else as well.
Yeah. It's an interesting question. I mean, I think what it does, I mean, like, if you and I had been having a conversation in 2015, 16, 17, I would be making the kind of shows we're making on The Rest Is Football, you know, relatively straightforward chat plus archive shows, you know, hopefully in a compelling way with great talent and great archive. I'd have been making that as a commission for ITV4. They'd have been commissioning me to make six shows. They'd have been paying me, you know, not very much money, frankly, and we'd be eking out a living to a degree. I think now we're hard on the heels of those traditional organizations, and we're just saying, we don't need your money to make that anymore. We'll make it. We'll find the audience for it. We'll distribute it to them, and we'll monetize it. We've just basically missed out the middleman. And I think, frankly, as a TV producer, that's an incredibly powerful opportunity and a creative opportunity, because, I'm very good friends with Niall Sloan, who's the head of sport at ITV, but I'm in a better position if I do not have to persuade him to give me part of his annual budget to make those shows. I'm in a better position because, you know, love him as I do, he's got to spread his money around and get the best bang for his buck. And he's got a lot of challenges. He's got to buy live rights, etc. Now, I don't need to do that. I can just say, do you know what? Wouldn't it be brilliant if we had archive rights for the Premier League and could make a show about, you know, about David Beckham or Eric Cantona, which we've now done. We've just done it ourselves. So it's liberating, frankly, from a creative perspective.
Yeah. What's that done to how you think about the archetypal goal hanger show? Because there was a period where you could kind of identify what the model was. It was find two people, knowledgeable people, good chemistry, good balance, if they're depending on the subject matter, and get them to talk about that for 40 minutes a week, and you know, or what have you. Is that now, are you now taking that in a different direction? Will it kind of become more expansive again? How do you think about the archetypal goal hanger show in 2026?
I think if we lost sight of what had made our shows popular, that would be a mistake. I think, you know, fundamentally, why do people like our shows? I think it is because of strong casting, great characters, brilliant conversations. We have a very, very clear tone of voice, I think. You know, I don't tell any of our people what to say. We're not a newspaper that's got an editorial line and everybody has to stick to it. We're not, you know, we're not one of the newspapers that seems to never diverge from a single point of view. We're absolutely encouraging of diversity of opinion. We want to be civil all the time. We've got a tone of voice to us. We've got, hopefully, we're always entertaining. Like I listen to Radio 4 in the morning sometimes, you know, and I think, bloody hell, you know, it's like it can be unremitting misery if you're not careful. And I loved Radio 4. I've listened to it all my life. But, you know, there are times when I think now, wow, you know, I am of the belief that people want all manner of entertainment. And, you know, why is our history show the biggest podcast in Europe? It's because it's unbelievably entertaining at the same time as being informative, really well researched. The relationship between the two central hosts is brilliant. People are listening. You know, we're getting down. This week we did a thing on Samuel Johnson. Like, how, that's our biggest ever 24-hour download figure. How has that happened? It's not because people are obsessed with Samuel Johnson. It's because they trust Tom and Dominic on that show to deliver an enormously engaging hour. That's why. So, sorry, that's a long answer, Owen, but basically what I mean is I don't think we should be throwing the baby out with the bathwater here. We've got a fundamental success story at the heart of what we do, and we should stick broadly to it.
Yeah. I did notice that you've got a new show out about literature. The book club. You've dropped The Rest Is as a. I was wondering how far you could stretch that.
Yeah, I mean, look, not all our shows are called that. We've got Empire. We have Ways of Making You Talk. You know, we've got other shows. But I mean, The Rest Is a brilliant brand, and what it does is it gives new audiences to new shows a confidence about what they're going to get. So The Rest Is Science, for example, Hannah Fry, Michael Stevens. It is brilliant. If you're into science, it's fantastic. It's very entertaining. It's super clever. But it's also got the same tone of voice, broadly speaking, as The Rest Is History and The Rest Is Classified, The Rest Is Politics, The Rest Is Money. You know, broadly speaking, that you're going to get something that will be really entertaining while being super smart. So the brand really works. But, you know, somebody said to me, you know, how far will you go with it? And I said, well, you know, The Rest Is Football, yes. The Rest Is Badminton, no.
you talk about people, audiences knowing what to expect. The other thing that has happened you've been really effective at is building communities. And, you know, we talked a lot about advertising at the front end, but you know, important revenue stream for you guys and increasingly for other kind of podcast studios at your kind of scale is subscriptions.
I'm
assuming it's kind of baked into the strategy for when you launch a new show that you're going to end up with this subscription element to it. But, you know, how do you find the path to creating that kind of value that someone is going to pay for?
Yeah. So the thing about subscription is, and we've got 260,000 paying members, right, is that it's a really, really good test of your quality, because we don't force people to join our clubs. Or the vast majority, I think let's say we make 40 hours of content a week. 37 of them will be free. You know, you can just listen to them wherever you want, and we're never going to charge you. So why have over 250,000 people joined? It's because we're offering them a compelling content offer that means they think anywhere from £6 to £8 a month is good value. And it's a really good test, because they can leave anytime they want. And you know, we have to be on our guard all the time that we're providing a brilliant service. If we're not, they won't hang around. But we keep our churn levels really, really low because we really commit to it. We've built a content strategy around community, and you can sometimes sound a bit, you know, I don't know. I mean, we're not a charity, right? But I'm really proud of our communities because we've got vast groups of people that we are supplying content to who have a need or a desire for that content. So, you know, we've got a podcast that is just about the Second World War. It's absolutely brilliant. And if you're into the history of the Second World War, it's absolutely fabulous. Of course, it's niche, of course. But there are 10,000 people, you'll be shocked to believe, they're mostly blokes, broadly speaking, between your age and mine, right? 10,000 people are members, and it's the best thing that they're members of. And they come to one. We have an annual festival for them. 6,000 people turned up last year. We provide them with live shows on YouTube. They get to meet the host, James Holland and Al Murray. I mean, they are not going to hang around if you don't do something special for them. Mm. So I'm really, really proud of this because it might look overtly commercial, but it's not. The overtly commercial thing is to sell ads. The brilliant thing about membership is it's about building communities where they feel as though they're part of a wider group of people that share a passion and that they're getting something fabulous.
Yeah. And obviously events play into that as well.
Yeah.
What's next in that particular space? How much time do you spend on the event structure? A, to understand timing-wise, when's a good time when's a good point to put something on, but also to do something that's not just a live recording of a regular podcast. And
yeah,
you know, what are the opportunities there, do you think, as that grows?
So we don't really record our live events. They're not for that purpose. They're not, you know, come and join us at lunchtime while we record the pod. They are a community thing. They're an outreach thing. We don't do them for the money. That's not the point. Frankly, putting on a live show is hard work and quite expensive. You wouldn't do it unless, you know, there was another, well, we wouldn't do it unless there was another really good reason. So for example, The Rest Is History is having a 2-day festival at Hampton Court this year. It's only for members. The whole idea is you have been good enough to be, to join our club and to support the show for the last couple of years. We're going to have a big live event party with loads of historians come. Tom and Dominic be on the stage. Only you can come. And of course, we have to charge for tickets because it's expensive to put on. But it's an exclusive event, members only. And most of our live strategy now is about taking the shows to the most passionate part of the audience. I went with The Rest Is History to America last year, and we did shows in seven cities. And when the boys came out in Los Angeles, at a theatre in Los Angeles, it was like we put the Beatles back together, you know, because this very passionate American audience for the show was so delighted to see them turn up in their hometown, and you know that they really showed it. And it was a fantastic moment, both for Tom and Dominic on stage, but for the production team behind the scenes, thinking, "Wow, we've built something that's got this level of fandom. It means you're doing something right, hopefully."
Yeah, you had Conan O'Brien in the mix as well, I think, during that period.
Yeah, Conan's a massive fan. He's been a member of the Rest Is History Club for years. And when we got access to some of the Beatles archive, he's a massive fan of the Beatles too. We asked him, did he want to come over? And he jumped on a plane the next day and came and recorded a show with the guys with Tom Holland in London. Yeah, so we've got some fun. We've got some funny members. You know, we got my favorite emails of all time to info@goalanger.com came from Bob Iger, the head of, of Disney. And at first, when we saw it, we thought, this can't actually be Bob Iger, but it was Bob Iger. I was at an event recently, and Anthony Scaramucci introduced me to Mark Carney, the Canadian Prime Minister. Sorry, terrible name dropping, but he introduced me to Mark Carney, and Anthony said, "Oh, this is Tony. He runs Goalhanger, who made The Rest Is History." And Mark said, "I had never missed an episode. I've been a member for 3 years." It was absolutely amazing to have that conversation with a current acting, you know, head of state.
Yeah, yeah. Good that you can find the time. the notable thing, and you know, this, as I said, is we talk about sport and stories on this podcast. Just The Rest Is Football at the moment in that part of your stable. Mm. Is there scope to do more, or is it a question of finding the right kind of presenter and topic fit, or, you know, what are your thoughts in that space?
Yeah. So first of all, we have to find the right sport. I've been pitched almost all of them. And so you have to believe that, I mean, our, by and large, our business model is what's called always on. We make shows every week, all year round. We record shows over Christmas. When Marina Hyde went on holiday to a Greek island last year, during, you know, she's the presenter of The Rest Is Entertainment. Joey from The Office went out, met her there, and recorded the podcast on her holiday. We're not joking around with it. We take it really seriously. You will get two episodes of The Rest Is Entertainment every week of the year, right? So you have to also then think, like, we thought long and hard about cricket. You know, is there a year round appetite for cricket content? And there is. You know, there are successful podcasts out there. You know, we've looked at F1, we've looked at boxing, we've looked at rugby. I just feel that sport is really well served. It's not an obvious area where there's loads of unserved audiences. You know, you make a podcast about, you know, we make a podcast called Empire with Willie Dalrymple and Anita Anand. And it started out basically because we wanted to explore the backstory of the British Empire, particularly in this appropriate to India initially, but, you know, it's grown into something much bigger. But, like, there was nothing serving the community of people who are interested in that. Likewise, the Second World War. Likewise, our history products, I felt could really make an impact. I felt very strongly that the people in the country were really bored with the level of political discourse in this country. People shouting at each other on the radio. It was like tedious, unpleasant. So we wanted to do something different. I think in sport, it's harder. I think it's not so clear cut where the underserved audiences are. And, you know, there's so many good shows out there. You know, there's lots of good things to listen to. So it's not as obvious an opportunity.
Yeah. So would it be a question of if would it be a light bulb thing that if the right idea came across your desk or, you know, you had the right conversation and you pursue that more than it being something where you're actively trying to find an opportunity?
Yes, I think that's fair. I think it's actually most likely to be the right talent.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if Lewis Hamilton calls up and goes, I'd love to do something about F1, then, you know, we'll certainly be taking that meeting. But, you know what I mean? It's going to have to be something that just stops us in our tracks and makes us say, you know, Richard Osman contacted Gary and said, I'd love to catch up with you. Can you bring the gang together? I want to talk about doing an entertainment show. Like, we literally couldn't get there quick enough to make that happen. It's going to have that kind of fabulous talent opportunity, I think, to encourage us to do it. I mean, there are so many things we want to do. It's like, how do you pick your best opportunities?
Yeah. Okay. Well, we'll look out for all of that. Three questions. Sure. I know you're keen to go off to a well-earned lunch, but three questions we ask every guest. The first is, do you have an origin story or something that sparked your interest in sport?
Well, I mean, not very many people follow me on Twitter, but and rightly so. But I mean, if you see my Twitter personal description, it is very simple. It says Burnley fan, and I am an absolutely dyed-in-the-wool Burnley supporter. I am a season ticket holder. All my three sons are season ticket holders, which isn't bad when you think that they were born in the Chelsea and Westminster Hospital and live in Battersea. My dad is a Burnley supporter. Burnley is my team. It's by far. I've been around football all my life, worked in it. I've seen so many games. I'm basically now just a Burnley supporter. I just want to see us play all the time. You know, I never want to miss our games, even though we're absolutely dreadful, miserable, worst season I can ever remember. I was still at Burnley Brentford last week and I was at Palace the week before. So it goes back. And the origin story really is that my dad took me and I completely fell in love with the game in 1979. We lost away at Preston 2-1, and I've been going ever since, and always will.
Yeah, is that the Alistair Campbell connection there?
That's how I knew Alistair. I knew Alistair through Burnley, and I was in the media a long time, and he's a very prominent figure, and we kind of bumped into each other a few times. He knew I was a Burnley fan. We stopped and chat, and then when the rest of history had done really, really well, and I wanted to do a politics show, Alistair was the most obvious person to go and have the initial conversation with, and that's actually how it happened. And he suggested Rory Stewart.
There you go. What's your favourite piece of sports storytelling?
By somebody else?
Yeah.
So I have got what you might.
Well, I mean, something you're proud of as well, but you know.
Well, I've got a number of, you know, I've worked in TV around sport a long time, so I've got some very name droppy friends, right? You know, and I'm very good friends with Roy Keane, so who I adore. He's an absolutely amazing man. And I think in recent years, the audience has come to understand that he's much more than a kind of, you know, the kind of slightly pantomime version.
Yeah, there's a bit
imagined.
Of kayfabe with, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, and Roy is, well, Roy's the best story, football storyteller you'll ever hear. So I made Keane and Vieira Best of Enemies, my first ever show as an independent, because I was, because Roy always surprised me by telling me stuff that I just, that was so surprising that, and so honest and intelligent and funny and insane that I thought I've got to try and capture this. And I think, you know, I'm very proud of that film. But really, Roy Keane and Patrick made it, and especially Roy.
Yeah. Anything by anybody else?
Storytelling.
Yeah.
I mean, I when I left ITV, I actually took advice from Gareth Southgate, and he was one of the pundits at the time. This is pre-England. 2013, and he said to me, I said, I'm not sure whether I should leave, you know, I love this job, I love working on the Champions League, big boxing nights and everything, but I do have this itch to scratch, which is to set up my own production company, start making content again. I got to be a level of seniority where I was in an awful lot of meetings and not making an awful lot of telly, if you know what I mean, and I wanted to try and get back to my roots a bit. And I said to him, what do you think? And he said to me that when he'd been offered the Middlesbrough job, he had gone and spoke to Terry Venables, his favorite, you know, the England manager he worked best under, and said, what do you think, Terry? And Terry had said to him, this isn't a rehearsal. You get one go at life. They've offered you the job. Go and take it. And in a way, it was kind of like a good kick up the backside to me to do the same thing.
Yeah. Okay. What is a sports story you would like to tell or see someone else tell?
I'd like to tell the story of how Burnley got promoted to the Premier League and somehow had a miraculous, you know, I don't know. I mean, that's obviously never going to happen. I love sports stories. I watch tons of them, you know. I'm amazed we've never seen the Leicester City Premier League title story told properly. You know, Gary was obviously at the absolute heart of that, covering it on Match of the Day, and of course ended up presenting Match of the Day in his underpants. But I'm amazed that's never been told. I'm a great boxing fan. I love the shows that I did in the noughties. You know, I did a lot of Joe Calzaghe's show, Big Fights. I don't know. There's tons of sports stories. They're endless, aren't they? They never stop. That's why we love them so much. And what's interesting actually is that my kids, who are 21, 19, and 17, all massive football fans, they're just as interested in watching Zinedine Zidane and Cantona from the 90s. As they are watching, you know, Mo Salah and you know, and the top players of today. So I think that storytelling in football and sport more generally, it's always going to be there, and it's always going to be the way that you get to the very, you know, to the passion of the story and to the souls of the fans. Is I watch my son sometimes watching Diego Maradona and think, bloody hell, I watched that game in '86 live as a little boy, you know, as a school child, and it still stayed with me to this day.
Okay, well, it'll be fascinating to see how those stories come out. But Tony, it's been a really enjoyable hour, and yeah, thanks so much for your time.
My absolute pleasure.
Outlines is an original production from 2640.